Hello, I'm Alia Adam. This is number 0661, the Stuff File Program, with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you. And yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0661. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, we remember comedian Gilbert Gottfried, who recently passed away. We share a brief conversation from 1994. In it, he talked about getting the role of Iago in Disney's Aladdin.
First of all, Disney looked at Aladdin and they said, this film is too Gentile even by our standards. We gotta get a Jew right away. And they just said, get us a Jew, we don't care who it is. It could be Ben-Gurion, we don't care. Get us Alan King, just get us a Jew right away. And they got on the hotline to me and I did it. And then I lived with a family of parrots for a year to get into character. Because, you know, if I didn't, then parents would watch the movie and go, I don't walk that way.
John Tebow, author of How to Change a Law, on old antiquated laws that are on the books and how the general public can do their part to change them. There are three steps to getting a law changed.
The first thing is you have to clarify your issue. The second is you need to build a coalition. And the third thing is you need to appeal to a higher authority. And while it seems very simple, there's actually a lot of little steps involved in doing that. But every member who presents a law goes through that process. And you see it when somebody presents a bill and then they have to get co-sponsors to sign up for it. In other words, even if an elected representative is in office, he can't get it done or she can't get it done unless they can corral some other people and say, look, would you agree with this?
Stuart Nolman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nolman, and Book Banter marks Holocaust Remembrance Day with a captivating book that answers the questions dealing with the fate of Anne Frank and her family, with Rosemary Sullivan's The Betrayal of Anne Frank. So share this story of historical closure with me later on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guests later. The person who told you this was show number 0661 was Alia Adam, who is the anchor host of Global News Weekend at Global Toronto, and a former co-worker when we worked together here at Global Montreal many, many years ago. Thank you very much, Alia, for doing the guests late on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make the show an even bigger and better radio experience. Now, let's get right to the stuff. The 71-year-old romance novelist Nancy Crampton Brophy of Beaverton, Oregon, is on trial for the murder of her husband. Daniel Brophy was found shot to death at a culinary school where he taught. A key piece of evidence has been excluded from presentation to the jury, a post on her blog titled, How to Murder Your Husband. Though she wrote, and I quote, I find it easier to wish people dead than to actually kill them. She continued that the one thing I know about murder is that every one of us have it in him or her when pushed far enough. Judge Christopher Ramirez excluded the post from consideration because it had been written years before for a writer's workshop, and its usefulness was substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice and confusion of the issues. The judge has allowed evidence of her online searches for ghost guns, as well as her purchase history of multiple firearms, which she says were part of her research for writing mystery stories. Well, she's either a moron or someone found the perfect person to set up. Which brings me to a concern I've had for years. It's about Jessica Fletcher in Murder, She Wrote. For a dozen years on TV, this woman terrorized the small community of Cabot Cove in Maine, which has to be, per capita, the murder capital of the world. I mean, all those crimes that she so-called solved? What a coincidence!
I don't believe in coincidences, especially when they involve murder or attempted murder.
Have you noticed she's always at the right place at the right time?
Miss Fletcher, you have quite a reputation as an amateur detective.
But I'm really not a trained investigator. Even my fictional heroes have to have some clue to go on. I mean, if a murder was committed, where is the body?
Doesn't this sound like a woman with a fetish?
Would you please call an ambulance? And hurry. This woman's poisoned me.
You didn't follow her here, Justin. You came here to kill me.
Yes, the whole community is out to kill her, and they're sloppy at it. Plus, Jessica is often the last person to see the victim alive.
Maggie told me you were her killer just before she died. I realize now that she'd begun to suspect someone who was systematically swindling her out of hundreds of thousands of dollars. When I arrived to see her the day she died, she was in the middle of a disturbing phone call.
Don't say things like that! Well, just stop it right now! Just stop it!
Rather than talk about it, she asked me to bake her a cake.
Well, do you remember where I kept the recipe?
Mm-hmm. I haven't made one for years, but if that's what you want, I'll have another go at it. Now, it seemed very odd then, but what I realized now was that she was really saying, look in my kitchen cooking files, where I found the trust agreement and her checkbook.
And someone left the cake out in the rain. Seriously, when will we lock this woman up? At the very least, put a real scare into her.
Let's scare Jessica to death.
A Bellevue, Washington man had a large tree on his property that he wanted removed. This tree was 140 feet tall and almost 3 feet in diameter at its widest point. Since he didn't want to pay for the removal, he posted online asking someone to do the job in exchange for the wood. Someone accepted and started cutting, despite the wind, rain, and hail. About 30 minutes in, the unnamed tree cutter told the man things were, quote, out of control, unquote, and suggested he call a tree removal crew. A short time later, Sarah Jacobson was out on an errand. She and her husband both work from home, and he was home when the tree crashed through their home and into the living room where Sarah usually works. Nobody was injured, but Turning Leaf Tree Service had to use a large crane to remove the tree from the house. They said removing the tree properly would have taken 5 or 6 people and would have cost between $3,000 and $4,000. So free can be expensive. Removing the tree properly wouldn't have stumped this cheapskate. By the way, could you imagine if Sarah hadn't gone out for errands but was instead working in her living room? Yeah, right about now, Jessica Fletcher would be snooping around.
Where is the body?
And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first segment here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, 57-year-old David Stover has been telling workers at a Wendy's restaurant in Florida that he's an undercover DEA agent ever since his buddy who worked there left in an effort to continue getting a discount on food. The store manager told investigators Stover would even flash a badge when asked for proof. Unfortunately for the fast food fan, the badge was a concealed carry permit, and police were called to Wendy's on April 11th because Stover was arguing with the staff. He was arrested for impersonating a law enforcement officer.
Hi, welcome to Wendy's. May I help you?
No, that's okay. I'm going to jail where the best I can hope for is prison food.
These are delicious. Aren't you amazed at the quality of these vegetables in a prison?
I'm amazed at what's crawling around in our soup.
Anyway, let's get to our first segment on this edition of the Stuff All program, shall we? We have lost yet another comedic giant who has gone too soon. It was just months ago that Bob Saget died suddenly, and now one of his comedic contemporaries and a close friend of his, Gilbert Gottfried, has died after a long battle with muscular dystrophy at the age of 67. It's ironic that as people continue to debate the slap heard round the world, Gilbert Gottfried was a comic that never shied away from going there comedically, regardless of the repercussions of his words, and there were many repercussions. He believed that comedy was comedy, no joke was too soon, and he stood by it, never apologizing for his act. He was uniquely funny and a talent who was unafraid of stepping on the third rail. I had a short recorded conversation with Gilbert, which we'll feature for you now. It's short because most of what we talked about was off the record. Plus, we were having lunch together at the Delta Hotel, which was ground zero for the Just for Laughs Festival. The year was 1994, and Gilbert was already a comedic mainstay with movies, television, many appearances at Just for Laughs, and yes, controversy. Here is that conversation now.
So you've been here several times now at the festival, Just for Laughs, and your career has progressed along rather well with each appearance. Not that the festival is responsible for your appearances, but or your success. But how would you assess your career at this moment?
My career is in the toilet. It's just totally gone. It's over. My career is over with. At very best, I can hope I can gain about 60 or 70 pounds, become an alcoholic, and do episodes of Murder, She Wrote. Maybe I'll show up as a pickpocket in a future Matlock episode, but other than that, it's all over for me.
Well, you've worked for Disney on two occasions. That's one more time than Peggy Lee has.
Yes, but me and Peggy Lee are going to work together one of these days. Yeah, I did Aladdin, the parrot in Aladdin, and also The Return of Jafar. And the Return of Jafar is in videotape. That's in video. You can go out. Go out to your video store and rent that now. Rent it now. In fact, we'll wait here. You run out and rent that. And I'm not going to say anything further until you've rented that and watched it. And once you've rented it and watched it, then I'll come out. But other than that, I won't say another word.
How would you describe your career? Because I'm not going to describe it for our audience.
Okay, let me see how I can describe it in words that you can actually use on radio. How would I describe my career? Let's see. Mongoose, to put it in one word. Yeah, I don't know. It just is a good word, and it's a word I like using. So I'll have to describe it in as mongoose.
Well, let's go back to Disney then.
Yes.
You've done the part of the parrot. How was it getting that role, and how long, how arduous a task was that, putting it together? I understand it's a lot of time in studio.
Yes. Well, first of all, Disney looked at Aladdin, and they said, this film is too Gentile, even by our standards. We got to get a Jew right away. And they just said, get us a Jew. We don't care who it is. It could be Ben-Gurion. We don't care. Get us Alan King. Just get us a Jew right away. And they got on the hotline to me, and I did it. And then I lived with a family of parrots for a year to get into character. Because, you know, if I didn't, then parrots would watch the movie and go, I don't walk that way.
A lot of comics have come through the comedy club routine, the circuits, playing big shows, and then go into sitcoms. We haven't seen the Gilbert Gottfried sitcom yet. Why not?
Eventually I'll have to write a sitcom for myself where I'm a single parent who has obnoxious, precocious kids, because I don't think that's been done before. I think it's going to be something new.
Are the networks afraid of Gilbert Gottfried?
They should be, because I carry around sharp objects with me.
I noticed that you haven't been on the Emmys for a while.
Yes. I am not welcome on the Emmys because of my Pee Wee Herman routine. Right, basically said I sleep better at nights knowing Pee Wee Herman's been arrested. If masturbation's a crime, I should be on death row. And for some reason, they didn't like that. Go figure.
Do you have a problem working with networks? Is that one of the reasons why we don't get to see you on network TV, or you're not interested in doing network TV?
Oh, no, not interested at all. I'd grab anything that came along. Believe me, if they wanted me to be with one of the twins on Full House, I'd take it.
If you could write your own ticket tomorrow and say, this is what I would like to do with my career, this is either the movie or the show that I'd like to do, what would it be? What is a perfect venue for Gilbert Gottfried?
It would be one day's work, make it 10 million, because I can write my own ticket. 20 million. Okay, 20 million, one day's work, and a lot of nudity. My luck, it would be with Brian Dennehy, but granted.
You are now doing the, as you said, you did the second Aladdin film. Robin Williams did not.
No, because he hates me, basically. Basically, he called them, he said, is Gilbert Gottfried working on this? They said, yeah. He said, well, then I'm not.
Between the two of us, I understand that the Disney studios can be a little bit cheap. Is that true?
Them cheap? Ha, ha, ha. Oh, what an active imagination you have. Them cheap? No, for the first film alone, which brought in like $20 billion, I got a hat. And I think they're going to be sending me a Mickey Mouse bumper sticker.
Will he be doing a third Aladdin?
I'm sure, till I squeeze every penny out of it.
Thank you for talking with us.
Sure. Yeah, I had to talk to someone.
That was a brief recorded chat with Gilbert Gottfried from July 28th of 1994. As I mentioned, we were having lunch. Gilbert was a brilliantly funny and deep guy, and despite what you heard when he performed, when he was off stage, he also had a normal speaking voice. As I said earlier, as a comedian, he was unafraid and it cost him. You heard him mention his unwelcome routine at the Emmys. While he wasn't the Affleck Duck yet, back in 1994, a gig that would come 6 years later, he would lose that gig after 11 years because of a joke he made about the Japan tsunami. By the way, Affleck gets 75% of its revenues from Japan. He was also probably the first to talk about 9/11 when he was part of a roast for Hugh Hefner. In some corners, that didn't go over too well either. Regardless, Gilbert Gottfried was unabashedly fearless as a comedian. It's ironic that both he and Bob Saget would leave us so close together, because in the pantheon of comedy, when anybody asks the question, what's the dirtiest, filthiest, funniest joke that anybody has ever said on stage, the winning joke would be a ditty known as The Aristocrats. Many a comedian has done a version of that joke, but nobody, living or dead, has better versions of that joke than Bob Saget and Gilbert Gottfried. You can find both versions somewhere online. Both were different, both were filthy, both were extremely funny. And now both of those comics are gone. Gilbert Gottfried, dead at 67. Gilbert, it was a pleasure and an honor to have chatted with you, to have watched you, and to have dined with you. You will be missed. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
There's still more guests, more news, and an idiot of the day coming your way on the Stuff File program. Stay tuned. The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to the Stuff File program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll tell you how to change a law. Plus, Stuart Nolman is along with another edition of Book Banter. We do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way, and much more in Stuff File news right here, right now, on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. So let's get back to it, shall we? An Oklahoma man has been arrested after being caught trying to steal an Audi from a dealership in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and claiming he was acting under the duty of a U.S. Marshal appointed by former President Donald Trump. The man, identified as Randy Cantwell, allegedly went into a dealership to view the car. When an employee said it wasn't ready to be driven, Cantwell said he was taking it anyway and claimed the dealership stole the car. According to the Tulsa Police Department, Cantwell told employees he was a federal marshal and could take the car if he wanted. The employees blocked the car in, and when Cantwell realized he couldn't drive away, he got out of the car and began to walk off. Cantwell was eventually stopped by police, and when asked what gave him such grand authority, he allegedly provided the most natural answer. He was a federal marshal, a role he took on when former President Donald Trump enacted martial law. Wow, where would he get such a cockamamie idea?
When somebody's the president of the United States, the authority is total. And that's the way it's got to be. The fact that I don't want to exert my power is much different. The federal government has absolute power. It has the power. As to whether or not I'll use that power, we'll see.
Oh, yeah. That. Of course, Trump never declared martial law or authorized anyone to steal luxury cars. But the QAnon conspiracy theory has long suggested that Trump would enact martial law and order mass arrests of the internal enemies of America, including a supposed group of cannibalistic pedophiles who secretly rule the country. Wow. Never mind the possibility of whether or not John F. Kennedy is really dead or his son JFK Jr. is really dead, I'm beginning to wonder if Rod Serling is really dead.
Clown, hobo, ballet dancer, bagpiper, and an army major.
Person, woman, man, camera, TV.
A collection of question marks. Five improbable entities stuck together into a pit of darkness. No logic, no reason, no explanation. Just a prolonged nightmare.
A Brazilian man had to undergo emergency surgery after reportedly shoving a dumbbell up his butt during an ill-advised attempt at self-gratification. A case study detailing the exercise in stupidity was published last week in the International Journal of Surgery Case Reports. The unidentified 54-year-old patient had reported to a hospital after failing to extract a 4.5-pound metal weight from his rectum for 2 days after inserting it there. He experienced a variety of symptoms following his sexercise, including cramping, abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting in small volume, and even constipation, said the study. Gee, I know a study has to be thorough, but seriously, does the word even need to be before the word constipation? I mean, he's got almost 5 pounds of metal up his butt. Constipation should be a given. Anyway, after an initial anal examination failed to reveal anything, doctors decided to scan the region with an X-ray. They discovered an 8-inch-long dumbbell lodged at the intersection of the colon and the rectum like a cumbersome sex toy. After failing to extract the object with forceps, the surgeon was forced to go in manually with their forearm. They initially attempted to use tweezers to lift the weight out of the pleasure seeker, who was sedated, probably much to his chagrin. Anyway, the surgeon yanked out the foreign body like a backed-up steer. The operation was successful, and the lucky fellow was discharged after 3 days sans any complications. I'm guessing he wants the doctor's phone number, though. The case study reports that retained rectal objects generally affect males between 20 and 40 years old, and while the condition is still exceedingly rare, the report states that there has been an uptick in thrill seekers putting junk in the trunk. In March, doctors diagnosed a Tunisian woman with a urinary tract infection, only to discover that she had a shot glass lodged in her bladder. She had reportedly used the drinking vessel as a sex toy 4 years ago and didn't get it checked out until much, much later.
Bottoms up.
Wow, that's showing some patience. Let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? There are some strange laws out there. For instance, in Gainesville, Georgia, eating fried chicken with a fork is illegal. And in Mississippi, public swearing will get you 30 days in the slammer. What can be done about these laws? John Tebow is the author of How to Change a Law. He's also the founder and CEO of iLobby. Formerly, he was involved in government affairs at MCA Universal and VP at eBay. And he joins us via Zoom from California. Hi, John.
Hey, Peter. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So these laws that, and by the way, there have been stories about laws that haven't changed in decades or outdated laws in both Canada and the United States. Here in Canada, we even had a show about it, a television show. So these laws are on the books And for some reason, we don't know why they're on the books. Like, for instance, the one I just described, Gainesville, Georgia. Not eating fried chicken with a fork, which, by the way, I have done, so I'm apparently a criminal. Why is that a law?
Well, I think when I looked at these, I think a lot of them are obviously, as you said, they're very old, and in some cases, even 100 years old. And in the case of local communities or municipalities who put some of these on, they could be vanity laws. So someone just didn't like the other guy on the council and said, you know, you can't eat fried chicken because it isn't decent or whatever. But again, it doesn't apply to today. The other thing I've noticed about many of these is that they're admonitions. You know, you cannot do this, you cannot do that, you shouldn't do this, those kinds of things. None of them are encouraging laws saying, hey, you should, you know, apply to Harvard. They don't say that. It's like, don't do this bad thing.
Okay, so you wrote the book, How to Change the Law. What made you write the book in the first place?
Well, what's interesting is when I worked at Universal, I was working in government affairs and got exposed to, you know, lobbyists, attorneys, members of Congress and the Senate, and within the entertainment industry realized that they had a method for figuring out the kinds of issues they wanted to tackle and then get them done. And it seemed very easy to me at the time with the group that we were working with, where you would bring together issues regarding intellectual property or the entertainment industry or piracy in the early 90s or mid 90s, all of those things. And years later, I realized that most people, you know, in Canada, the US, and most democracies, they're not aware of how you work with government and how things operate behind the scenes. Whereas corporations, for the most part, large companies, have government affairs offices, but most of us don't realize that.
That's interesting. So can people change laws? And when I say people who are not large corporations.
Yeah, I think that's a real challenge. I mean, what we normally see is individuals who are protesters or they sign a petition and they hope that that will actually have an impact. My thought about that is sometimes it will, you know, if they're really, really active, but often it does not. However, there are cases, and I'll just give you a quick example of this. I'm in Silicon Valley, and in California, in the district that we're in, for the last 10 years or a little bit longer, there was a senator, California State Senator Joe Simidian, who had a contest, and he said that the contest was called There Ought to Be a Law. And what he did was he encouraged his constituents to supply problems that were going on in the community and then say what they thought a law should be around that. And of the several hundred he received every year, he would select 5 or 10, and then he would sponsor those on the Senate floor. The person who won, it was considered to be a contest, the person who won would have the law sponsored by him. He would corral the other members of the Senate and the Assembly and then get it passed. And then in effect, what they would do is they would win a flag that had flown over the state capitol. They would get some press notoriety, and then obviously the pride of authorship. Now, the interesting thing is that the individual who submitted the idea, they didn't have to draft the law. All they had to do was submit a paragraph or two, probably 200 or 300 words explaining what the problem is. And so each year there were numbers of them that got passed and turned into law. And these were by real people in the real communities who made a difference. This contest actually then ended up going to other parts of California, not that far, but it also actually migrated to some of the senators and representatives in Philadelphia, in that area, in Pennsylvania.
How serious does a law have to be? And by that, I mean, as you are fully aware, there are certain laws that are making the news these days. I won't go into any details about them, but there are some laws that are rearing their heads that have some people alarmed that some of these laws seem to be draconian, going back to a different period of time. So when you say anybody can enact a law or can get a law enacted, does it depend on the seriousness of what the issue is and how many people it will affect?
I think, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book, How to Change a Law, are the three basic sort of steps. And what I've tried to do is take what is a very complex thing and simplify it. So I'm not going to unpack all of these, but an individual or the group or a sponsor, anybody who wants to do this, they've got to do three things. The first thing is you have to clarify your issue. And then we can talk about that. Clarify your issue. The second is you need to build a coalition. And the third thing is you need to appeal to a higher authority. So it's sort of the ABCs of how you get it done. And while it seems very simple, there's actually a lot of little steps involved in doing that. But every member who presents a law goes through that process. And you see it when somebody presents a bill, and then they have to get co-sponsors to sign up for it. In other words, even if an elected representative is in office, he can't get it done or she can't get it done unless they can corral some other people and say, look, would you agree with this? And so there's kind of a reasonableness test, I suppose.
So what you're saying here, the laws that apply, literally the laws that apply to getting a law changed, does that differ between municipal, state, and federal, or does that apply for all three levels?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think this model that I'm talking about does apply to all three levels. But I'll have to admit, at the federal level, things are, well, first of all, there's much more transparency. And that's why you and I and probably many of your listeners are familiar with all the things that we see, because the media focuses on those. But the same steps would be done at the state or provincial level, or at the municipal level, or even at a homeowners association. And then what you'll find is, as you move down to the local level, it's actually a little simpler to get things done.
Now, I mentioned in the intro that you're the founder and CEO of iLobby. What exactly is iLobby?
Well, iLobby was an outgrowth from the idea with the book that people could come together and do crowdfunded lobbying. And again, I realized there was a real difficulty for people to tackle that kind of thing. So I haven't pushed that as hard. I think that, you know, I've used the example of we're in a state of political literacy where people are learning how government works, how politics works, how civics and democracy work. And it's not very unlike what happened, I think, in the early 70s when most of us started understanding what financial literacy was about. And we were given the opportunity, you may recall, to buy a stock and not pay $99 for one trade. But then when Schwab introduced it, you could do it for $9.95. And then Fidelity came around and others. And so we had mutual funds and all kinds of products. The interesting thing to me is that those things were available. This is hard to believe, but they were available to the very wealthy in the 30s and 40s. And the American, the Canadian public didn't get this stuff until the 70s or 80s. And then obviously by the mid to late 90s, half the population was involved in the stock market. I think we're at the same point with political literacy. We're just learning to do it. But the people who know how to do it don't talk about it. And those people are, again, your top corporations, top lobbyists, attorneys, and politicians.
Is political literacy made easier or sometimes muddied by the advent of social media?
I think it's muddy because what's happening is we have lost our appetite for debate. I mean, I think, you know, you alluded to that. And what's happened is we're seeing this bifurcation of ideas. You know, it's like I am completely right in everything that I do and everything you say is wrong. And I won't even listen to what you have to say. That's actually not a good way to solve problems. One of the things that I learned from, you know, the software side of things, having worked at eBay and Financial Engines, was in order to improve a product or a process, you have to listen to the dissenters, because often they will say, hey, look, yes, I'm criticizing you and this little thing doesn't work, but this is why. And what they can do is they can actually make it better. What we do by shutting off debate is we just say, I think I know what the problem is. Here's the answer. And that's it. And then we end up with what we were talking about at the beginning. You end up with stupid laws, bad laws, ridiculous laws, and they never come off the books.
I mentioned iLobby. When people go to the website, what will they find and how can they use it?
Yeah, the website is iLobbyCO.com. And it's mostly, if you think of it as educational at this point. So it's information regarding how to build a debate, how to draft your position. There's videos you can watch, those kinds of things.
And as we mentioned earlier, I mean, you're living and working in the United States, but you're actually here from, you're actually from Canada. So do the things that apply to the website and what you can learn from it apply to both countries, even though laws are different?
Yeah, I mean, it's based mostly on my experience here. And I know there are nuances and differences between the countries in terms of, you know, your Charter of Rights and the First Amendment here and the Bill of Rights and those kinds of things. But I think the generalized principles would apply to most democracies. So I look at it like maybe the specifics aren't exactly right, but if you were in, you know, Germany, Italy, France, England, Canada, Australia, much of the, and again, I have readers in those other countries, and they've come back and said, oh, wow, this is really fascinating. I can tell you where it doesn't work. It doesn't work in third world countries or repressive regimes. They don't want to hear from you.
Right. It's a fascinating topic. Again, the book is How to Change a Law. The website is ilobbyco.com. John, thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
It was great being on, Peter. Thanks so much.
John Thibault, author of How to Change a Law. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the page number for this show, which is show number 0661, and you'll find links to John's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holden.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And here he is, once again, in the flesh, Stuart Nauman. How you doing, Stu?
Pretty good, Peter. You wouldn't, accept me any other way, would you?
No, I would not, actually.
No. I am not a figment of your imagination.
That's good to know. That's good to know. Yeah. So what are we talking about this week, sir?
Well, here on Book Banter, because Holocaust Remembrance Day is here, and
yeah, it's coming up on the 28th of April.
Yes, that's exactly, and I figured to to keep in the spirit of this, I want to review here on Book Banter a book dealing with the Holocaust, especially one that's been out recently that's been capturing a lot of headlines. The betrayal of Anne Frank in particular.
Right.
So let me just preface this by saying that throughout the 12-year period between 1933 and 1945, which saw the persecution and the systematic murder of over 6 million European Jews at the hands of Nazi Germany, that's known as the Holocaust, there have been many individuals that personified the suffering and agony as well as the courage and the hope of this harrowing and sorrowful period in modern history. Such people that come to mind in that respect include Hannah Senish, Oskar Schindler, Raoul Wallenberg, Simon Wiesenthal, and Elie Wiesel. But perhaps the one person to emerge from the Holocaust who represented innocence, maturity, and optimism in the face of such immense tragedy was Anne Frank. She was born in Germany and raised in the Netherlands. So Anne and her family consisted of her father Otto, her mother Edith, and sister Margot, along with four other people, hid for 2 years in an attic located in the annex of the warehouse of her father's business at in the heart of Nazi-occupied Amsterdam, and it's the address is Prinsengracht 263, which has now become a museum, actually. Now, during that period, Anne recorded her hidden life in the attic, as well as her thoughts and reflections that occupied the mind of a teenage girl during a time of war, in writing through a diary. And that diary, which was unearthed after the war, was published in 1947 as the Diary of a Young Girl, and has become a perennial bestseller around the world, and to this day is recognized as one of the major literary works to evolve from the Holocaust, along with Elie Wiesel's Night and Art Spiegelman's Mouse. Now, sadly, the fate of Anne Frank and her family is just as well known as her diary. On August 4th, 1944, a group of Nazis and Dutch policemen, based on information they received from an individual, raided the attic and arrested its 8 hidden occupants. They were later deported to Auschwitz. Anne died in Bergen-Belsen on January 6, 1945. And out of the 8 individuals who were arrested, only Otto Frank survived.
Mm.
Now, until his death in 1980, Otto became the keeper of the flame of the Frank family, especially the legacy of his daughter Anne and her world-famous, widely read diary. But he was also concerned with the person or persons who informed the Nazis that led to their arrest and why. So with that question left unanswered for nearly 75 years, it took the efforts of a retired FBI agent, Vincent Pankoke, and a team of crack researchers and investigators from around the world to find out the answer. So using effective FBI methods, the latest in computer technology, not to mention poring over countless documents and conducting interviews with the descendants of the people who knew or were associated with the Franks, the team treated the search for answers as if it was a criminal cold case, which helped to find out who was the person or persons responsible for betraying Anne Frank and her family. So Canadian author Rosemary Sullivan has chronicled this unique search for closure in her captivating book, The Betrayal of Anne Frank. Now, Miss Sullivan begins the book with a very informative backgrounder that takes up the first half, as she gives the reader a thorough historical perspective to the Frank family and the harsh 5-year Nazi occupation of the Netherlands that touched every Dutch inhabitant in a tragic manner. Now, perhaps the most disturbing, infuriating part of that brutal occupation was the fact that many Dutch citizens, as a way to profit from the Nazis' anti-Semitism or to save their skins from the sting of Nazi occupation, became bounty hunters known as V-Mannen or V-Frauen or Jew hunters, in which they would inform the Nazis about Jews who were in hiding and the locations where they were hiding for a nominal sum of money for each Jew who ended up getting captured as a result of their collaboration. And the second half of the book details the exhaustive work of the cold case team to find out who was instrumental in this betrayal. The narrative almost reads like an episode of CSI or Law and Order, as the team members utilize their specific specialties and skills to get to the desired outcome. And like an Agatha Christie murder mystery novel, it details a list of probable suspects, their possible motives for involvement with the betrayal, and the circumstances why they were or were not the perpetrator in question. And yes, the reader, the team managed to find out who was the perpetrator that committed this betrayal. And in all fairness to the readers, I will not reveal the name and the motive behind this heinous act. All I can say is that the betrayer was a member of the Amsterdam Jewish community, one of their own.
Wow.
So basically, the betrayal of Anne Frank definitely unlocks the mystery of the fate of Anne Frank and her family. And although the book provides a much sought-after sense of closure in that respect and keeps the legacy of Anne Frank and her diary alive for many more generations to come, the main question of why still hangs over us, to why over 6 million European Jews had to suffer a terrible fate at the hands of Nazi Germany between 1933 and 1945, and why nothing or very little was done to prevent such a massive tragedy to happen. That question still has yet to be answered.
Okay, so again, without mentioning who the person is, but it is explained in the book, do we know if that particular person has any relatives or living descendants?
Yes, I do believe so, actually. I do believe so.
Because that could be problematic.
Oh, of course. Of course, it could be. But for all we know, these descendants could have decided to go under another name.
Right.
It's very possible.
You are someone who not only reads a lot, but you sometimes or often reread something that you may have read years ago. So I'm just curious to know if, after reading this particular book, have you gone back and looked at The Diary of Anne Frank with different eyes?
Well, not yet, but I plan to. I mean, the first time I read the book, it was for grade 9 English class. And I knew before that, a lot of, my sister read it when we were in our teens, and a lot of, young girls and young women read the book. It was basically a must read.
Not only that, but you mentioned you read it in grade 9. Yeah. I did the same, and I was thinking when you were talking about the book, just the original book, The Diary of Anne Frank.
Yeah.
Without getting overly political, there are schools that would never allow that book in the school again, and that's sad.
Yes.
That is just sad and wrong, but,
Yeah, it happened. The same thing happened to Mouse just recently.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I have to give, just quickly, I have to give credit to the publisher of Mouse. When they heard about this, this ban in a certain state school, they decided to give out copies to students anywhere for free so they could have a chance to experience this two-volume graphic novel, which is now a main part of the Holocaust literary canon.
Mm. Anyway, this week's book is
The Betrayal of Anne Frank by Rosemary Sullivan. It's published by HarperCollins, and it's $34.99.
And what other books in this genre do you recommend, sir?
Well, of course, if you're going to read this book, you have to read The Diary of Anne Frank.
Right.
And luckily it's readily available, so that's in paperback, so you can go to any bookstore and find a copy of it. And also, I just want to recommend highly a series of memoirs that are written by Holocaust survivors who came to Canada, after the war and made a good life for themselves. It's called the Azraeli Foundation of Holocaust Survivor Memoirs. It's a series of over 50 books, which are published in both English and French, and it just gives a great perspective on different aspects of the Holocaust from the survivors, as this is now basically their will and testament to their horrendous experiences and also their survival.
Right.
Especially in Canada. And one quick example was a recent release called Promise of Sweet Tea by Pinchas Elianu Blit, who survived and lived in, went to Montreal, became a lawyer, and also an actor in Yiddish theater. But his memoir centers around his village in Western Ukraine and how the Holocaust and what he went through parallels with the basic virtual disappearance of this village that he grew up in.
Well, Stuart, let me piggyback on your recommendations with a couple of my own.
Okay.
As you may know, I have spoken to many people through the years in connection with one aspect of the Holocaust or another. Several people have written books on these topics. Several of them have been on the show. But I'm going to recommend two.
Mm-hmm.
And the two books... one is by Bram Presser, who is the former frontman for the internationally acclaimed punk rock band Yidcore.
Mm-hmm.
He's the author of The Book of Dirt, and it traces the Holocaust roots of his grandparents in a book that is part memoir, part investigation, and part novel. Both of his grandparents died in the same year that they survived the Holocaust. They immigrated to Australia. They died in the same year, and he was very, very close to his grandparents, particularly his grandfather. And he had heard a lot of his grandfather's stories, and he decided when his grandfather died that he was going to dig deeper into those stories and find out what was truth, what was fiction, so on and so forth. And it's an interesting look at what his grandparents went through, particularly his grandfather. So that book is called The Book of Dirt by Bram Presser. And the second book is by a man by the name of Stan Goldman. He shares his mother's survival from two death camps and also tells how his mother's release literally led directly to Adolf Hitler's suicide.
Mm.
And the book is called Left to the Mercy of a Rude Stream. So you can check that one out as well. And by the way, I've done interviews with both of those gentlemen, and you can listen to them on Audia, and I will put the links in on this week's page for this show, which is number 0661, so that you can listen to both of them. They're both fascinating stories. So again, yes. This week's book is?
It's called The Betrayal of Anne Frank by Rosemary Sullivan, published by HarperCollins, and it's $34.99.
And where can one find you, sir?
Well, you can easily find me within the pages of the Montreal Times every week or on the website, www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
You're very welcome, Peter.
That's Stuart Nolman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. I've got a few more Stuff File news stories to share with you, plus an idiot of the day, so let's get right to it. A birthday party for an employee at Gravity Diagnostics in Kentucky cost the company $450,000, but it wasn't an expensive cake and decorations that ran up the bill. The employee, whose birthday fell back on August the 7th, asked the office manager days before to forgo the usual celebration because such affairs trigger his anxiety disorder, and being the center of attention would cause him to suffer a panic attack. However, the manager went ahead with planning a lunchtime to-do in the break room, which caused the guest of honor to flee to his car to eat his lunch. The next day, the birthday boy was called into a meeting and scolded for his reaction and was later fired because of the events of the previous week, according to a lawsuit he filed against the company. In the suit, the former employee said the company didn't accommodate his anxiety disorder and caused him to suffer a loss of income and benefits and emotional distress and mental anxiety. The Kenton County jury agreed and awarded him a six-figure amount. Well, good for him. Great way to stick it to the company. Full disclosure, in every place I've worked, HR usually keeps track of birthdays so that the company can do what they believe is the team-building waste of time of stopping everyone in their tracks to mass sign a card, sing happy birthday, and eat cake in honor of someone they probably don't like anyway. I've always nipped this nonsense in the bud by asking HR if they have given out my social insurance number to anyone. When the person behind the desk incredulously responds, "Of course not! That would be a violation of your privacy!" I then remind them that since we're fully aware of the ground rules, then you can't share my birthday either, as that would be a violation of my privacy too. This usually stops them in their tracks. When anybody asks me when my birthday is, I usually tell them it's a secret. I've never even told my parents. And when they ask me what my sign is, I respond, "Slippery when wet." In Australia, Queensland's Bill Edgar is known to some as the coffin confessor. As such, Edgar shows up at funerals and speaks for the deceased, telling off family members, setting friends straight, and delivering bad news about beneficiaries. But Edgar's job doesn't stop there. His service, for which he charges $2,000 to $10,000, have expanded to removing items from the deceased's home that they'd rather the family not see. Said Edgar, could be sex toys, messages of hate, love, whatever it is they've written down and they want removed from their web browsers. One gentleman had a sex dungeon in one of his bedrooms, and that gentleman was 88 years of age, believe it or not. Edgar even delivers his services to the United States and United Kingdom, and he said Paramount has picked up the story for a movie. I'll bet he's doing a bang-up business. I wouldn't need his services, though. I don't have any secrets. Well, except my birthday. But then again, after I'm dead, who cares? And now, boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff Off presents The Idiot of the Day.
Some people think they can talk their way out of speeding tickets. I'm sure cops have heard every excuse under the sun. In this case, a guy was stopped for speeding in Flagler County, Florida. Now, I've actually seen the transcript of the dialogue, which was recorded via the cop's body cam. I won't bother to list the lame lies and excuses the driver spewed in trying to get out of a ticket for driving over 50 miles per hour in a 30 mile per hour zone. The reason why I won't bother is because, well, they're lame. But I will mention his last excuse. And here it is, word for word, as the desperate driver literally went for the nuclear option. He said, and I quote, "I just found out. I'm trying to tell you the truth, guy. I just found out that Putin said he's going to launch nuclear thermal war against the world, and I was trying to get back to my house to find out what was going on." Yeah. Now, why, oh why, would you think that telling a cop that you were racing home because Vladimir Putin was planning to launch a nuclear war against the world, and you thought that was a viable excuse? And what were you going to do when you got home? Turn on your TV and duck and cover? Why would you think that a cop would buy your story? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0661. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And once again, that's 0661. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including KDXRadio.com, TrueTalkRadio.com, streaming on Audible, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, WLSLLPFM in Dade City, Florida, CKUWFM in Winnipeg, CFMU in Hamilton, CKLU in Sudbury, and local 103.7 FM in St. John. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Before we go, we'd like to leave you with a helpful instructional message from the National Association of People Who Have Trouble Walking and Chewing Gum at the Same Time. Step, chew, step, chew, step, chew, step, step. I always screw it up.